This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pancava. As the primary season revs up and candidates work to convince voters they're ready for the job, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has a few things to say to the winner of the presidential election. Albright is supporting Democratic presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton, but she offers up advice for whomever becomes the next president. In her new book, Memo to the President-Elect, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership, Albright argues that the 44th president of the United States will have to have the programs and the personality that will help America return to its role as a global leader. Madeleine Albright served as the U.S. permanent representative to the United Nations in the first term of the Clinton administration. In 1997, she became the first woman to serve as Secretary of State. She weathered some storms during the Clinton years, as when she pushed for military action in Kosovo. And 10 years ago, then Secretary of State Albright was among those advocating the use of force in Iraq if Saddam Hussein did not comply with more thorough inspections. But as the Bush administration was building its case for war with Iraq, Madeleine Albright was cautioning that it had not prepared thoroughly enough. Here she is speaking in September of 2002.
It is naive to think that a peaceful and democratic Iraq will automatically emerge from the ashes of our invasion. It is crazy to believe we can run post-war Iraq alone. And it is essential the administration think through the consequences of all this in advance, which it is not evident to me that they have done.
Half a decade later, the would-be presidents are confronted by the question of Iraq and the troops still there. But that's only one of the thorny challenges Madeleine Albright lays out in her new book, Memo to the President-Elect. She spoke about those challenges on January 14th in an appearance at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum. And it's that speech we're about to hear this hour on Word for Word. Moderating that session with Madeleine Albright was Harvard University professor Joseph Nye, who begins the conversation.
Let's suppose that it's January 21st of next year, and the new president is faced with a legacy of Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, Palestine, and the list goes on. North Korea, we could. And one of the things that is interesting is if you're talking about how can we restore America's reputation and leadership, is how does the new president escape the inherited legacy? If he or she ignores any of those problems I just described, she's dead or he's dead. I mean, it'll sap their energy, their presidency, and so forth. On the other hand, if they get mired down in those problems, they wind up continuing Bush's foreign policy. Maybe not all the details, but the agenda is the same. And it's interesting, a few years ago, Vice President Cheney said, someday, 10 years from now, people will judge us as a success. And what's more, in the next election, the next president, whoever it be, will have very little choice but to follow our agenda. How does a new president escape? How do they solve or cope with these problems and not let them define them?
What I get at in the book is that this is going to be an incredibly difficult presidency. I think people are ready for a new president. Some people are ready for a new political party, but I think generally there is a sense that it's hard to believe there's another year of these people. So but the bottom line is, and what the point that I make in the book is, so you've won, and now what? This is going to be very difficult. I think one of the hardest points for me is exactly the one you asked, because we've both been in administrations. We have both been in the process where you come in new, and we have also been transitioned into. And foreign policy doesn't come in four-year segments. The rest of the world doesn't quite abide by our electoral season. And so there are certain issues left on the table, and you have to figure out how to deal with them. I have been very critical of the Bush administration when they came in to decide that everything that we had done was wrong And they themselves talk about it, having adopted a policy of ABC, anything but Clinton, meaning that wherever we had left the talks in North Korea, for instance, I'm still the highest level American official to have ever gone to Pyongyang, but we were in the middle of negotiations, and because we had done them, Secretary Powell was not in a position to continue them. And he talks about the fact that he was prepared to carry on the negotiations, and the Washington Post had a story that said Powell to do Clinton policy, and he was called into the Oval Office and said, no, that's not going to happen. So as a political scientist and foreign policy person, I think it would be a real mistake to just flat out say everything that has been done in the Bush administration is wrong. I think that the next president is going to have to take inventory during the transition period and decide what is workable and what isn't. So, for instance, if indeed President Bush is right and he can get a peace agreement on the Middle East, then there would be, I think, various aspects of that that should be picked up, implementation in a variety of ways. And while I think, for instance, that the six-party talks on North Korea lost a lot of time. If that is moving forward, then one would try to pick up. And I think it would be a real mistake for a Democratic president to say everything. I think there should be some inventory, as I said. But I do think also that the next president has to set some priorities. I am advocating in this book that we actually get rid of the 100-day gimmick, that it is something that worked for FDR because he was working within a totally different context on a specific issue, and that there are just too many issues together. We were in the Carter administration together. President Carter, after 12 years of Republicans, had basically set too many priorities, and he would go to Congress, and I was working at that stage for Senator Muskie, asking too many things. And so some priorities. So I would get rid of the 100 days. I would then try to list the inventory and pick these issues and then pick some that had to be done. And obviously, from my perspective, ending the war in Iraq and then now added to that Afghanistan, Pakistan is the real thing. And just as an example of math, if you set three priorities and you accomplish two, you've done two-thirds of what you wanted to. If you set 10 priorities and accomplish four, while you've done double what you want, what the two, you still have accomplished much less in terms of the overall number. So I think setting the priorities and not thinking that you have to overthrow everything.
I think that's wise counsel. But let's stick with Iraq for a minute. About a year ago, the view was that Iraq was sucking all the energy out of everything else in Washington, and that was going to be the dominant issue of the campaign. Now the op-ed pundits are writing things like the surge is working, the Democrats are going to, they're basically going to undercut the progress that's made. The new Democratic president will essentially do what you just said, stick with the old agenda, undercut the progress, and that is going to lead to a foreign policy disaster. What do you recommend on Iraq?
Well, first of all, I think the next president has to tell the American people the truth about Iraq, really explaining what it is that's going on in a way that sets the story out. I have no doubt that the surge is working. Our military is brilliant, and they will do in the best possible way what they have to. The problem is that, in fact, until this debathification law that was passed, the reason for the surge was to create a an environment for a political solution, and there's not enough evidence of that. So I think it would be a very big mistake to continue the policy of the Bush administration on Iraq. I have said in my previous book, you know, when you write a book, we all know, you hope that what you write and predict will come true. I'm sorry that this actually has, because in that book I said that I thought Iraq would go down in history as the greatest disaster in American foreign policy. And I believe that, which means I think it's worse than Vietnam, not in the number of Americans who've died or Vietnamese or Iraqis, but in terms of its unintended consequences. And those are not going away. in addition to not getting a political solution in Iraq, we have created mayhem in the region, and every day there is some kind of proof that Iran, in fact, is the country that has gained the most out of it. So I do think that there has to be a change in policy. Where I think it might have changed some, not saliency, but the kind of discussion in the campaign is that getting out of Iraq has to be done in a much more kind of calibrated way, and trying to figure out how to withdraw the troops in a way that does not create more chaos. I think those of us that, well, you were at the Defense Department, in terms of that I learned, where a force needs a force to protect it. And so there has to be some maintenance of forces there as we get people out. And then something I hadn't focused on till I'd read an article about it is that the materiel that has to come out, first of all, we can't leave it there because who knows whose hands it would get into. And it has all been, it's filthy. It's full of all kinds of desert bugs and things. And given our environmental issues, we don't want to bring the stuff back. On the other hand, there's not enough water in the place to wash it down. So there are all kinds of issues that I think people need to think through. And I think I read an article today which indicates that we are finally learning about counterinsurgency, and General Petraeus is the expert on that with his manual. But I do think that the next administration has to end the war and then figure out how to move the troops out and deal with the problems in the region. So the agenda has to change.
You are a long-time and well-known supporter of human rights and concerned about humanitarian issues. Suppose we begin a gradual withdrawal, as you describe, and it turns out that what's happened is that we've armed the Sunnis, and Muqtada al-Sadr has basically had a unilateral ceasefire for the Mahdi army, and that as we draw down, they say, now's our chance, and we wind up watching a much larger civil war than we've got there now. Do we have to reintervene for humanitarian reasons?
I think, you know, it's interesting because actually it was at your Kennedy School last year when I was talking. You know, everybody is eager to get us out. And one of the students there asked me the question is, do we have any moral responsibility to the people of Iraq, or more specifically to the question you asked? And I think we do. The question is, what is the best way to deal with it? I don't think that, I think it would be a mistake for us to re-intervene, but I do think that we have a responsibility to try to develop some kind of a peacekeeping force. One of the things that stunned me, now let me just make quite clear, I'm not contacted very frequently by this administration, but one of the things that happened, just as they were starting the war, they called a bunch of us into the Pentagon. And were trying to persuade us that this was a truly great idea. This was not a consultation. This was a propaganda activity. And Doug Feith, who was one of the architects of this mess, put a PowerPoint up. You know how, well, you were part of the PowerPoint generation. The Defense Department is really good at PowerPoint.
It's way to obscure the issue.
Yeah, absolutely. But what all of a sudden he put up the fact that the American military would turn over everything to the Iraqis. And I said, so how long do you think that will take? And he said, well, not very long. And I said, well, do you have a timeline? No. Have you thought about some kind of an international interpositional force, which is something that we'd done in the Balkans? No, we won't need that, he said. So there never was any thought about that. And I do think that in order to avoid what you're talking about, that we should begin to think about some kind of a peacekeeping group. And the other thing that I've said, and this is not very popular when I say it in Europe, but the United States did not start World War I or World War II. But when we saw that it affected our national interests, we went in there and turned it around. Europeans particularly disagreed with the way the war started, but I do think that their national interest is even more affected than ours in many ways, and they need to get in there and help. And I think that diplomatic push is something that needs to be, we need a diplomatic surge in terms of trying to get ready for what you're talking about.
You have a really very good chapter in the book, which I think you call No More Iraqs, about how to deal with Iran, which does a very clear-headed cost-benefit analysis of the use of force against Iran, which says, boy, we will be the big losers from this. And it's extremely well-argued, as one would expect. But what are the prospects that we can imagine that in 5 to 10 years that Iran will be a non-nuclear country? And if not, at what point do we use force?
Well, I have done something else in the book, which I think is important, is to give a little bit of context of why our relations with Iran are so difficult.
Right.
And they go way back, but in 1953 with the overthrow of Mossadegh, and then the our dependence on the Shah, and then the hostage crisis, and a variety of things that make life fairly difficult for us with Iran. I think there's several issues here. Iran definitely has gained out of all of this, and it is Persia, after all. And the interesting part is to visualize the Persians in the middle of all these Arabs, and while there is a connection among the Shia, it still is Persians and Arabs. And I had a very interesting discussion with King Abdullah of Jordan, who talks about what he foresees is a potential issue of Persians versus Arabs, which is a very difficult and serious issue to contemplate. You are the expert on nuclear proliferation issues, and I think it's clear that the non-proliferation regime is broken. There are loopholes in it, and what basically happened was that the Iranians just have a right to a peaceful nuclear program. And the question is whether there can be any way that the international community, the IAEA, can in fact inspect what they have and get them under control. I do think that it is very dangerous for Iran to become a nuclear weapons country. And the options are not great, frankly. But there is some hope internal that there are divisions within the Iranian society. There's some interesting developments there where the Ayatollah all of a sudden is saying a few things that are different from Ahmadinejad, who is not doing too well, that the large portions of the populations are pro-American, that there are real divisions there, and I think those need to be looked at. I think the military tool can never be taken off the table. But I think it would be a real problem to use it because Iran knows how to not only, in fact, have weapons, but to fund a variety of terrorist groups. They have with Hezbollah and Hamas, and they have funded terrorist groups in Latin America, and that would be loosened, I think, if we were to use the military force. The question, and I actually would ask you, why, if deterrence worked so well for 50 years, and one assumes that they, maybe not Ahmadinejad, but that the Ayatollah is a rational player, that in fact deterrence in some way might work. And to try to figure out how to work with different elements of the Iranian society, try to get the international system into place, but and keep the force tool on the table, but do more with deterrence.
I think that's right. I mean, in the academic discussions about this, there are a number of people who said, who have said that it's possible to deter the Iran. That the idea that it's hell bent on suicide is simply not the way it is. And there is a view that when we think about nuclear weapons, it depends on what kind of a country has them. So we ought to be working, if we have 10 years, we ought to be working to have a different type of Iran if it ever gets nuclear weapons and not the kind that we have today, and that a premature attack is guaranteed to produce the wrong kind of Iran. But you don't worry a lot about French nuclear weapons,
right,
and much less about Russian weapons than we used to.
But I think one of the things, I point out that the next president is going to have 5 huge trend issues to deal with. The first one is fighting terrorism in a way that doesn't create more anti-Americanism.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is to deal with this broken nuclear proliferation regime. The third, just briefly, is to restore the good name of democracy. The fourth is to deal with the negative aspects of globalization. And the fifth, that whole bundle of issues to do with global warming and energy. And just by naming what those are, a different style of work in terms of cooperation. So if the Indian nuclear agreement goes through, and it's now got a problem with the Indians, then I think some thought is to take that as the basis of some kind of a new non-proliferation regime, have the new president submit a CTBT to the Senate and work on a fissile material cutoff treaty so that there's a whole host of issues that come together and then work on a different Iran.
You do say that democracy, what I think you call it democracy doubts, that what we've inherited or what the new president will inherit, whether it be he or she or Republican or Democrat, is a great deal of reaction against the democracy agenda of the Bush administration. People look at what's called democracy in Iraq and say, no thanks, I don't want that. You were deservedly praised for efforts at democracy promotion. What do we do now to recover? In other words, when there's a great deal of cynicism about democracy promotion as a result of the last 7 years, what do we do now to get back on track with democracy?
John mentioned this and that we had worked on it. So let me just say there was a meeting, two meetings at the White House where President Bush invited the former Secretaries of State and Defense. I have to say I never felt so young. I thought half the people had already died. But the president had come in and said, I need to have you all support democracy. And then it was not a particularly pleasant meeting, but as we were leaving, and he said, I want you to come into the Oval Office to see how Laura has redecorated it, I felt that I should speak to him. And so I said, well, Mr. President, I truly do support you on democracy. I only have one problem, one bone to pick with you, and that is that you act as though you invented democracy when actually I did. So he did at least laugh on that. But I think that, and I have to be very frank about this, in terms of, I am chairman of the board now of the National Democratic Institute. I was vice chair when it started, and it came out of an idea of Ronald Reagan's, a speech that he gave in London at Westminster in 1983 when he talked about the necessity of democracies organizing their message better. He didn't know about soft power yet, but basically how democracies explain themselves. And so he came back and suggested the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy that has under it a Democratic Institute and a Republican Institute and a Business and Labor Institute in order to help support democratic movements around the world. And I underline support. And it was a very interesting evolution in the last years of how you support a variety of movements, what you do not to undermine them. What has happened is that democracy's gotten a bad name because imposing democracy is an oxymoron. And what really, I believe in democracy, and I believe that countries are actually better off if they are run democratically. And as an American decision maker, I think America's better off if countries around us in the world are democratic. But democracy really has a bad name at the moment. And I think that what we have to do is be a little bit more humble about it in terms of not saying American model of democracy. We're not the only country. We have to work with forces within the countries and not tell them what to do. And we have to, and this is a hard part, I have to say I have discussions about this with my big D Democratic friends in Washington who are less inclined about democracy these days than they were before because it is viewed as Bush's imperialist democracy. And I think we have to figure out how to have this discussion among ourselves and then try to figure out exactly how to promote it. John Kennedy had some very interesting ideas on this subject and did a lot in terms of when he was talking about freedom in Africa for many countries. And I think we need to get back to that rather than democracy coming in with the military. That in itself is the part that has undermined the reputation of democracies.
I agree with that. What do you do, though, when you get to the hard cases like Saudi Arabia, where there's a considerable resistance even to the modest democratic agenda you're describing? Or take the case of Pakistan, where we're pressing President Musharraf to hold free and fair elections, but it's not clear that he's going to. If he doesn't, what do we do?
Well, I think that, first of all, I do think that generally we need to press the democracy agenda, but as we all know, whenever there are complicated relations with some country, we call it multifaceted, that we have multifaceted relationships. I do think that one needs to press the Saudis for their own good to open up, and King Abdullah actually, in a strange way, has moved some of it. What I find interesting is the question always is, what happens if the wrong people get elected? Well, that happens here, and so one has to deal. But I think there have to be a certain set of rules in order to get into a democratic election. And I find interesting, for instance, people say to me, so what happened with Hamas? Why did that, and I'll get to Pakistan in a minute. But basically, there should have been some kind of a entry fee for going into democratic elections. You have to give up force as a tool of your party if you are going to compete in an election. In Pakistan, I think what is so interesting is that Musharraf has really had a coup against the rule of law. That's what he ousted the Chief Justice. He then got rid of a bunch of judges, and so the rule of law was undermined by the leader. I think there should be free and fair elections. I think the question is how quick, I mean, they have now been set, but what has to happen, and NDI actually has had a delegation there, is to make sure that the electoral rolls are legitimate, that there are actually not kind of ghost polling places, and that there be international observers there. And if they are not free and fair, then they should so be declared. But, you know, that is never an easy thing. That's what just happened in Kenya, and there are all kinds of upheavals. But there's nothing about this that's easy. But I do think it requires sustained support, because it's much worse when there are coups against the rule of law and democratic elections are not held.
Let me take one of your other priorities that you outlined early in the book, which was the working on the reaction against globalization. One of the four key priorities at the beginning of the book that you mentioned is anti-globalization growing, and how do we do something about that?
I have to tell you what's interesting. I do have a consulting firm now, and people have actually come to me and said, how do we stop globalization? Well, you can't stop globalization. Mm. The question is how to manage it. And I have been asked to be a part of something truly interesting recently. I think many people in the audience, and you certainly know Hernando de Soto, the Peruvian economist, who has a very interesting theory about how the poor can be a part of society if they have legal rights. And for me, the biggest problem about globalization at the moment is the gap between the rich and the poor. If we were all rich, it would be very nice. If we were all poor, it would be too bad. But the problem is that now the poor know what the rich have. As a result of information. And while there is absolutely no direct line between terrorism and poverty, the more disenfranchised and disempowered people are, it creates an environment so that those who really hate us and hate everybody can find recruits there. So I think the rich-poor gap, for me, is the biggest problem. And so I'm interested in what I'm doing. Hernando asked me to co-chair an international commission with him on the legal empowerment of the poor, and a combination of looking at our development assistance and entrepreneurial skills to try to do something to mitigate that worst part. There are fewer poor people in the world today, but the gap between the rich and the poor is growing. And that's to some extent true in the United States, domestically also. And therefore, a combination of looking at business and entrepreneurial skills along with governmental action. So top to bottom, I think, is one of the big agenda items. And what is so interesting on Kenya, for instance, take as an example. We went there to do a consultation to see what really goes on, not talking to representatives of poor people, but poor people themselves. The poor are not stupid. And this is quite a story. We went to a place in Nairobi in Kiburu slum, a place called the Toy Market, which has nothing to do with toys. It just was called that. And it was about, I don't know, hundreds of stalls where people were selling each other spark plugs and flip-flops and T-shirts. And those people in that slum had organized their own credit system. And they each put one Kenyan dollar a night into this, and they then lent money to each other. As a result of what's gone on now in Kenya, that market has been destroyed. And if those people had any piece of paper in order to rebuild it, but to me it's the tragedy of not having legal empowerment.
Right. One of the great beneficiaries of globalization is China. But there's also something of a reaction against China in American domestic politics now. They're being blamed for low wages, which steal American jobs, and so forth. Do you expect the anti-globalization problem to lead to a more poisonous policy toward China?
Well, one thing you know from all our experiences together is that there is always a very different mood in campaigns. Every candidate of every party has always criticized any relationship with China during the campaign. And then right after, there's a recognition that you actually have to deal with China. And while this is not at all an elegant way for a political scientist or even a former Secretary of State to describe it, our relationship with China could well be described as that between a drug addict and a pusher. It's just that we don't know which is which. Because they are dependent on us for their market. They own large portions of our debt. And so we're going to have to work out some kind of a modus vivendi with the Chinese. What I find interesting is that when we were in office, and especially when I was at the UN, the Chinese were not that interested in a lot of issues except as they specifically referred to them. So whenever there was any question about what was going on internally in somebody's country, they didn't want anything to do with that resolution because they said, now people are going to be looking at what we do. What has developed more and more is they now do see some kind of a global role for themselves. They have, because of their energy needs, are all over Africa and various places. And I think what needs to happen is rather than seeing them as our chief adversary, we have to figure out how to bring them into some kind of a global management system to deal with the five issues that I raised in addition to others. We need their help on Iran, on North Korea, on Darfur, and in terms of how one runs this very complex world.
You're listening to Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State and U.S. Ambassador to the UN during the Clinton administration. She spoke at a John F. Kennedy Library Forum in Boston in mid-January. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
We've talked mostly about policy, which is the first two-thirds of the book, but I found equally interesting the last part of the book, which is about leadership and how does a leader implement foreign policy. I'm interested because I have a book on leadership coming out myself, but when I got to that section, I said, does she agree? And we do agree. But if I could push you a little bit on it, page 281, to be exact, after you're quoting with Gene Acheson and so forth, you say the most valuable traits to the job of chief executive include optimism, resilience, capacity to adjust to new information, a willingness to accept responsibility, wisdom in judging people, patience to listen, and ability to inspire cooperation among Americans and between our country and the world. That seems like a great list. The question I have is, how do we know that in an election campaign? Now, there is a famous quote that when Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes was introduced to Franklin Roosevelt, and somebody asked him afterwards, what did you think of the president? And Holmes's comment was, second-class intellect, first-class temperament, which he meant as praise, that it's not the guy or the woman who gets the best marks on the exams or is the biggest policy wonk. It's the person who has temperament, which has that list of traits that you just described. But as we watch these debates and these ads and so forth, how do we really get to judge, as citizens in a democracy, the temperament of our leaders?
I think with difficulty, I have to tell you, because the campaigns are very long, but not necessarily illuminating in that particular way. And to go back through that list a little bit, I think that, I mean, we have both worked for two very intelligent presidents. I think what is interesting, I have also said that I want to see a president who is confident but not necessarily certain about everything. Total certainty is impossible for a human being because we are human. But confidence in one's views, enough to have that temperament, to ask questions, to feel comfortable when somebody argues with you, to have also the patience to listen to new ideas, I think is a very important part. Certainty leads somebody to not even know what they don't know. So the bottom line is, how do you find that? I think that it is hard. I think one has to watch very carefully as issues kind of unveil themselves in a campaign, but also what is the connection between having grand ideas and then doing some of the things in terms of the patience, the capability of working through it? You and I have been involved in many campaigns together. I think that there are various times in campaigns where some of the temperament actually comes through. And it is usually when something very difficult has happened, or how the candidate treats people around him or her, or kind of immediate reactions to problems. But I think it's the hardest part, right, Joe, because people, you don't really know. Just in your personal relationships with people, you don't truly know all these aspects. The other part is that I think presidents often evolve in office. They don't just look older, but they also develop a capability of dealing with. Some shut down, and some develop this capability. I think that the leadership question is the hardest, and I'm very glad that you're writing a book on it. Maybe, John, next time I get to ask Joe the question. But I think that, for me, the dealing with the unexpected, I think that is a very big deal. And one of the things I say in this book is the next president, no matter how many transition documents there are and everything, will have to deal with the unexpected.
There's, to take a case of a particular leader, the Clinton administration, I think a lot of people argue that Bill Clinton became a better foreign policy leader in his second term than in his first term, that he did learn on the job. But I was struck by reading a book by your former boss and our mutual friend, Zbigniew Brzezinski, that came out last year, in which he assigned George H.W. Bush a B on foreign policy, and he assigned Clinton a C on foreign policy. He also assigned George W. Bush an F. But I was more, as a teacher, students always come in and say, why'd I get that grade? Yeah. What do you think about Spig's grading on the Clinton as a foreign policy leader?
Well, first of all, I think that sometimes people give grades when they haven't been consulted about what they thought, and Zbigniew Brzezinski was not consulted very often by the Clinton administration. But I have to say, I don't know whether this is true. You are teaching now. Students come in, and I've just said this to my class. When you come in here, you don't have an A, and you're working your way down from it. You actually come in with a C, and you have to work your way up for it. I don't know why he gave that grade, frankly, without being overly snide. I think that and I tried to read the book. I didn't like it. I think basically because he felt that there was not a grand strategy, that it was something that was done a little bit more ad hoc, which I think is part of the problem in the 21st century, is that, and the end of the 20th, is that the kind of paradigms that we all lived with didn't exist particularly. But I wouldn't give anybody an A. I think it is a very hard job. I actually probably would give Clinton the same grade that George Herbert Walker Bush had. And believe it or not, I might give this Bush a slightly higher grade towards the end, because I do grade my students on improvement. I think that he has all of a sudden, you know, the course I teach is the National Security Toolbox. Mm-hmm. He has discovered diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And his trip to the Middle East, while late, I think is useful. I think there was a very interesting op-ed in the Washington Post about the fact that our relations with Turkey have improved a bit. And so I think that there I might assess him a little bit differently towards the end, even though Iraq is the greatest disaster in American foreign policy.
Former Secretary of State and former Ambassador to the UN, Madeleine Albright, in conversation with Harvard University professor Joseph Nye. They spoke January 14th at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum, and they were talking about Albright's new book, Memo to the President-Elect, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. You're hearing them on Word for Word from American Public Media. Madeleine Albright also took questions from the audience. They were read by Joseph Nye.
What does the assassination of Bhutto mean for democracy in that region and for women in politics in Muslim nations?
Well, first of all, I think it is a huge blow to democracy in Pakistan in terms of who might be a new leader. Nawaz Sharif from the other party is not somebody that everybody likes. I thought it was a little, there is no natural leader of Bhutto's party, and it left a huge void. I think it is important to know that she was not the only Muslim woman leader. Indonesia's had a woman leader, Bangladesh has. It does happen in other countries, and she was not assassinated because she was a woman, at least as far as we know. But I think that it does leave a gaping void in the system.
Here's another one. How do you recommend we fulfill our moral responsibility to the reported 2 million Iraqi refugees?
Well, I think that we need to, this is a whole issue, generally how we deal with refugees, but I'm sure that there are various categories of refugees. There are those who have just been moved out of their countries and they are living abroad and we have to figure out how to get them back into Iraq and how to make sure that they can live a normal, decent life. I think there's a whole other group of people that are refugees that actually have helped Americans, who have helped in terms of being interpreters and helping the soldiers, and they are under very specific threat. And I think we should try to figure out a way to bring them to the United States. I think that they need protection. So reconstruction of Iraq in itself is one way, but I think there's a very special group that needs our protection.
And here's another one. How do you see poverty and disease in Africa as a threat to global security? In other words, how do situations like Darfur affect security, not just humanitarian concerns?
Well, I think that they do create a sense of insecurity and discomfort and provide then areas for recruitment of a variety of people who are anti the system or, frankly, just flat-out anti-American. They are people that have, first of all, let's take HIV/AIDS in itself. The number of people who die of HIV/AIDS unsettle whole regions and countries and make the governing of them more and more difficult. Then there are the issues of additional cross-border conflicts or ethnic conflicts often happen because there are the haves and the have-nots. And it creates a reason for people to argue over their fields or crops or whatever businesses they have. So it provides reasons for arguing, and then those might spread to larger and larger regions. You look at, for instance, the horror of Rwanda that has in many ways spread to the Congo. And so it just creates larger areas of conflict, which then have a tendency to spread to wider areas. I also think that one of the discussions asked a question, what is U.S. national interest? Do we consider that humanitarian intervention, the protection of people that are being ethnically cleansed or tortured or something, or just killed, and refugee displacement is something that Americans don't want to deal with in terms of our own conscience. I think Americans are the most generous people in the world with the shortest attention span. And so we have this tendency to get all exercised for national interest reasons in something, and then we go on to the next thing. And I do think it's in our national interest not to see people being ethnically cleansed, wherever.
If the United Nations peacekeeping force, which was just agreed upon to help the African Union try to create a peaceful situation in Darfur, if this fails, and there's some worry now that it might be in the process of failing, should the United States intervene itself?
Well, this is the issue that one goes back and forth on all the time in terms of what there's a whole new doctrine in international policy, and it's the responsibility to protect. I found very interesting when I was at the UN, and there we were, 15 countries sitting around the table talking about what was going on inside somebody's country. And I thought, isn't that remarkable that in the end of the 20th century we really care what's going on inside? And then on other days, we would be mostly arguing about commas and UN phrases like inter alia to try to figure out what to do about what's going on inside a country. And now there is this whole issue that as an international community, if the head of a country is not protecting his or her citizens, then the rest of the community has a responsibility to protect. It does get in the way of sovereignty, and it is one of the huge issues that are going to have to be talked about in the 21st century. Our problem at the moment is that our troops are overstretched, and it makes it very difficult for us to all of a sudden be involved in other peacekeeping operations. And the question is how, having tried, believe me, although not successfully, to get some larger number of troops into Rwanda at the time, I can see the great difficulty in trying to get American forces to intervene in Darfur. What I would hope is that there would be much greater pressure to put the UN for the UN forces are coming together, but they can't get in. And so I think that before we're not going to invade Sudan. And so the question is how to get the system to get the forces in there and get the United States to provide the logistical support and whatever number of forces that we can.
That leads to the next to last question, which is, you were ambassador to the United Nations. What should the next president do about the United Nations?
Well, I happen to be an advocate of the United Nations, and I kidded about the fact that the reason that I got to be ambassador to the UN was that I actually won the United Nations contest when I was a sophomore in high school for the Rocky Mountain Empire, which is Colorado, et cetera. And the reason that I did was because at that stage there were 51 countries in the UN, and I could name them all in alphabetical order. I loved being at the UN, and I found that what was so interesting when I got there in the early 90s was that all of a sudden the UN that had been paralyzed all through the Cold War could in fact begin to act, and the peacekeeping operations were very interesting and important, and the economic activities and the health activities. And then I used to go around and give a lot of speeches and say, for the price of a movie ticket, that people don't even know that children get vaccines and we get information about the next storm, and you can send a letter from one country to another, and airplanes can figure out, if they ever take off, their flight patterns. And so a whole bunch of things that the UN does that most people don't know. The UN needs reforming. There's no question about it. But it requires the U.S. to support it in order to reform it. So our problem when we were in office was that there are two sets of aspects of money. One are the regular dues, because it's a club, and the other are peacekeeping operations that cost a lot of money. And the U.S. was way behind on the peacekeeping operations, and we paid our dues late, because our fiscal year begins in October, and so we always paid late and created artificial financial crises. And at the same time, my instructions were make them change on everything. So our best friends, the British, arrived at one United Nations General Assembly and delivered a line they had waited more than 200 years to say, which was representation without taxation. And so it lowered the leverage. Now, there are people in the United States who think that the UN is a very dangerous organization, that it has, you know, black helicopters that swoop down in the middle of the night and steal your lawn furniture. And then there are lots of Americans who don't like the UN because it's full of foreigners, which frankly can't be helped. So the bottom line is it needs to be reformed because it's a very useful tool in terms of dealing with our national security issues.
Well, thank you.
Madeleine Albright. During the Clinton administration, she served as U.S. ambassador to the UN and later as Secretary of State. Her most recent book is Memo to the President-Elect, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. She spoke January 14th at a Kennedy Library Forum in Boston, a session that was moderated by Harvard professor Joseph Nye. Special thanks to WBUR in Boston for the recording we heard this hour. If you missed part of this hour's program with Madeleine Albright, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may do so by visiting our website. It's wordforword.org. And while you're there, you may also subscribe to our weekly podcast. It's free. And listen to any of our previous programs, including speeches by former Secretary of State Colin Powell, Gerard Powers on the ethics of exiting Iraq, and columnist Bill Kristol on conservatism in the New World. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.